Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special episode of Peculiar Pairings. I am your host, Celine. Hi, welcome. And as any of you who listen to our show regularly know, that I am not here with Matt today. Boo, sad. I know. I wanted to pop in and give you guys a little something special since we haven't been able to do our typical recording, which it's mostly my fault. But actually, we had to take a little break because I had a death in the family, which was my future mother-in-law. And with that, Matt had a few things that he had going on, so we decided to take a little break so that I could take care of family stuff, he could take care of his stuff, and we are hoping, crossing my fingers very tightly because I want to be back and recording for everyone, I am hoping we're going to have a show, episode, something on the end of April, on the 28th, so a day before my birthday. Yes, very exciting. I'm hoping we have something on April 28th for you. If not, we will have something the following week in May. And until then, what I wanted to do to give you all just some fun little content and kind of something I've been meaning to do is episode updates. I know. Shocking. I have seen some updates coming in on like some of the stories that we've covered and all of that. So I wanted to go through some of what I have been seeing going on and give you all little updates on 5 of our cases episodes at the moment. And I'm hoping I can do these as like a Patreon exclusive content once a month, just quick little updates if we have them, going over cases, breakthroughs, anything in between really. So with that, I am going to be going over the Stanley Hotel, James Craig, who is, I also called our arsenic dentist, and Alyssa McLemore. That's one of our earlier episodes. I believe that is like episode 8 or 9. I'm sorry, I was actually really off. Episode 19. I had to look it up. I knew it was earlier, so. And it was a while ago, you know, so close, kind of close enough. I tried. So with that, I have a whole list of fun sources for you guys. So I'm going to speed through them really quickly. I have lawandcrime.com. See, I mess up too sometimes. It happens. The cinemaholic.com, 9news.com, cbsnews.com, King5.com, DailyMail.co.uk, Fox59.com, and WTHR.com. Yay! So, without any further ado, we're going to start with the Stanley Hotel, which for anyone who hasn't listened to that episode, please go back and listen to it. That episode I titled Here for the Red Rum. Yeah, I know. Cheesy. And that is episode 54, so a little over 10 episodes ago. So if you haven't listened to that one, go listen to it now and then come back here for the updates. So since we have last talked, the hotel had been sold. I know, very, very sad and tragic. But not all effort is lost. The hotel was sold to an Arizona-based nonprofit. And the current previous owner, John Cullen, who I believe he still has a lot of involvement in the hotel, so that he still like kind of owns it or like manages it or something. He agreed to the sell, basically like to pay off current debts, use tax-free bonds and all of that, which were issued by the Colorado Educational and Cultural Facilities Authority. Basically so that they could pay off like a ton of debt, they could kind of get the hotel in a better place financially. So with that, one of their main drives is to help boost business during off season, or what is sometimes called mud season. And usually mud season specifically refers to the spring because it is wet and muddy. And with this new effort to bring in revenue, they are also planning on adding an additional 54 bedrooms, a new restaurant, and an 80,000 square foot film center and museum only devoted to scary movies. And they're going to call it the Stanley Film Center. And Cullen, personally, I thought this was kind of funny. Cullen is not a fan of horror movies because he doesn't like that they keep him up at night. Oh, he's just such a wholesome man. But he knows what the people want. And the people want horror and scary things. So he will provide. And with this, they're going to be working with a horror film production, which is called Blumhouse. And for anyone like me who does not know what they do, they helped produce some super popular horror movies like Insidious and Get Out. So definitely know what they're doing. So, you know, so far things for the Stanley Hotel are going great. When the hotel was bought by this other company, they retained all of the current staff of the hotel, so no one lost their jobs because of new management or anything like that. So things are definitely looking up for the hotel. They're looking good. So I'd say we could say that, you know, good things are happening and great for them. And with that, we're going to be moving on to James Craig, our arsenic dentist. So, James, where do we begin? If anyone listened to when I kind of mentioned a little update, which I believe it was like early March, I know I had mentioned it in an episode, and it escapes me how much detail I went into, but I do know that I did post a little thing on our Instagram where you could go and actually read to one of the local news articles that covered it. And just to kind of recap what was going on then, on March 8th, James and his team challenged electronic evidence in his case, which included the seizure of his cell phone, laptop, work computer, accessing his Google email and Google voice, whatever. And basically his team tried to state that like, oh, there's nothing there. And like, you didn't really need to take it. And like, that was unnecessary and all of that. And that motion was denied. And they also said that what was found on the computer with, in regards to like, web browser history should not have been considered just what was physically on the hard drive of the computer. And their reasoning was that that was beyond the scope of search, and that was also denied. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see what's going on with that. As of now, and I want to say I got this update like in the last day or two, if not like today on April 16th when I am recording this, he is now being accused for a second cover-up attempt. And just let that sink in for a moment. This is the second time. The first time, he was doing this. Oh, this is like a little. Oh, no, that was in June. Sorry. I'm looking right at it in my notes. In June of this past year, he was accused of soliciting a family member to tamper with evidence in his case, to, you know, prove his innocence. And we all know, James, that you can't do that. You can't. Having someone tamper with evidence to prove your innocence just shows you're hella fucking guilty, doesn't it? I laugh because it's so dumb. And his second attempt, and this is the second charge that he has been given now, was a cover-up from jail with a different person. So all this stuff has kind of come out, and sorry, I am yawning so much right now. Basically, he's trying to get someone else in his family to also help him with this, but doing it from jail where, you know, everything you do is monitored and recorded. So it's amazing to me how some of these people who are supposed to be so smart do so many dumb things. And it was also brought up around this time that one of Angela's close friends who has claimed, and I say this just because I don't know the true relation of this person and they chose to remain anonymous, they claim they spoke with her like almost daily and mentioned that her marriage, so Angela's marriage with James, had always been tumultuous, that he had had multiple affairs, and that he also had a pornography addiction, and that those things affected the health of their marriage. And we have more information on the supposed mistress. I'm like using air quotes because I feel like she's not really much of a mistress in this case, at least considering what was initially presented for the case compared to the way it actually is. And this is all from an interview with Karen Kane, who was the supposed mistress in the situation. She is an orthodontist, and I think she is currently like based in Texas, and she met James at a dental conference in early 2023. So this, you know, this was a few months before his wife ended up passing. And they met, they hit it off, you know, stereotypical story. One thing led to another, and we talked all the time and this and that. And they had made plans for her to come out and visit, which is when Angela was in the hospital, extremely sick, and then passed. And he told Karen that him and his wife were getting divorced. They're in the middle of all of this, which was a lie, and it totally has Chris Watts vibes all over it, as far as like the lying and the cheating and all of that, you know. And Karen stated that they had two dinners together and that she had no idea what was actually going on. And had she known, she would not have come and she would not have gotten involved with this man who was actively married. Because, you know, like She herself had recently gotten a divorce. So, like, she knew, oh, yeah, like, it gets messy. Some things maybe are a little convoluted. Like, you might be working towards the divorce and have filed for divorce, but you are not actually on paper divorced. So she didn't think anything of it at the time until everything came out and she was like, I don't think so. So she stated in an interview, and she's given a few candid interviews since he's been arrested, and she does not speak to him anymore. No contact. Good for her. But basically, she said that, like, their relationship wasn't, like, a physically intimate one. It was more of that, like, emotional, they really hit it off and, like, maybe it'll go somewhere type of thing, but that's as far as it went. And that she doesn't think that him killing his wife had anything to do with her, because, like she said, they hadn't been intimate at all. So kind of hard to have that motivation behind murder. And honestly, I'm pretty sure that she didn't even know his wife was in the hospital until all of this was happening. And she probably had that whole idea that, like, oh, he's being there for his kids, and, like, this was his ex-wife who he, like, had a lot of happy memories and years with, and that, you know, even if you are an ex-spouse, you still have the experience of loss of that person and kind of, you know, trying to be a good person. So I feel like I cannot fault Karen for her involvement in any of what is going on with James. And as far as I am aware, he was supposed to start his case today initially, but then I believe it was postponed back in March, so it won't be happening until August of this year. So keep an eye out for more updates on that one. And now I have a little update, kind of, sort of, on Alyssa McLemore. And for anyone who hasn't listened to that episode, that is one of our earlier episodes. It's episode 19, which I believe we did like 2 years ago. So it's been a while. So brush up on that case. Refamiliarize it with yourself if you listen to it and you're like, man, I don't quite remember what that one was. Go listen to it. It's a great story, and I'm really disappointed, honestly, more because as of right now, in mid-April 2024, Alyssa is still missing. And just a quick little reminder for everyone, she has been missing since April 9th of 2009. And her aunt Tina, so Tina Russell, is still doing everything she can to get her niece's story out there, her name out there, to get justice for her family and closure. And as of February 27th, 2023, so a little over a year ago, she brought the case up, did an interview with K5 News about the case, just, you know, trying to keep it fresh in people's minds, which is such a great thing to do for a missing persons case. And she expressed that she had felt fairly disappointed because her niece's case, she feels, has kind of been falling through the cracks, especially because she is an Indigenous woman and it's so easy for those cases to be ignored. And that despite her case having this national attention and having a few serious leads that didn't go anywhere, that they've gotten minimal help from the local police in Kent, Washington, They have told her they don't have the manpower to take detectives and put them on an old case. So they're kind of like, well, if you can solve it, great. And that's exactly what her family is doing. They're like, if you don't do it, we will. Like, cool, we'll get a map. We'll search areas. Like, we're going to... They're very determined to find her. And I love that they are so determined. As frustrating as the situation is, it is so heartwarming that they are still fighting for her. They did receive a tip, I want to say, around that time. So in February last year, that her remains were in Lake Fenwick Park in Kent. And while they were searching, they came across a deep abandoned well on the edge of the park property. And they saw what appeared to be a tarp in the bottom of this well, but they weren't 100% sure. And of course, if like there is something down there, they don't necessarily want to go disturb it or, you know, like contaminate any evidence that may or may not be there. So, you know, they notified the police. And despite being notified about the well 4 years ago, they never followed up. They never searched for the well or took measures to cover it up as a safety hazard. And I mean, outside of the fact, like, if there isn't anything there, the family's worried that, like, a small kid or, like, a dog is going to fall into it. And then they could die down there, which is, oh, God, that's horrifying. I hate it. And, of course, shortly after K5 News spoke to the police, the officer Wales, who has, I believe he has the case or he's worked with it, him and his partner then went out to investigate and confirmed that they will further investigate the well, search it, and then eventually the well will be filled. So hopefully they got on it since then and it was actually taken care of at this time. I mean, I couldn't find anything that confirmed if it was or not. And her family stated that they felt like the city has not taken her disappearance seriously. And that's really frustrating. Especially for Alyssa's daughter, who was, I believe she was 2 at the time. Yeah, she was 2 when her mom went missing. And she is now 16 years old, so she's grown up without her mom since. And now, like, you know, she's helping in the search to find her mom. So if you want any updates on it, check out the Facebook page dedicated to her. You can just search Missing Alyssa McLemore if you have Facebook. And if you or anyone has information on her disappearance, please contact Kent Police at 253-856-8508 or email them at kpdtipline@kentwa.gov, or you can also call 1-800-THE-LOST, and that is 1-800-843-5678. I wish I had more. Unfortunately, I don't. So, you know, someone knows something and someone just hasn't spoken up yet. So hopefully someone does. And moving forward, I feel like it's hard to move on from something sad to another sad story. We are going to be talking more about the boy in the box, which for us was episode 30. It was a little case update that we did, and we kind of just talked about the case and like the update with the identity of the boy in the box. And for anyone who doesn't already know, the identity of the boy in the box is Joseph Augustus Zarelli, and his parents and family has actually been released to the public. Yay! I feel like I need like a soundboard or effects to kind of go in for all this stuff. Maybe I'll edit it, maybe I won't. You'll find out. So his identity was discovered November, December 2022, but the identity of his parents was not released to the public until January of 2023, and this was to ensure that all living family members could be notified properly, which I believe they did before they even released his identity to the public, since there were some people who were unaware that they were related. So they wanted to be sure that they had all the notification of it instead of being notified watching the nightly news, which I don't know about you, but I feel like if that's how I found out that something happened in my family that was something big like that, or it's like, oh, I'm related to that person, especially because, you know, the last name Zarelli is not exactly super common, I feel like I'd be pretty upset if that's how I found out. Just saying. So the parents of Joseph are Augustus Zarelli and Mary Abel, who went by Betty. They were not married, so at the time it was pretty taboo since he would have been born out of wedlock, and this would have been the early 50s. Both of his parents were Italian immigrants who grew up in West Philadelphia, which totally makes me think of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. In West Philadelphia, born and raised on the playground is where I spent most of my days. I'm going to stop there so we don't have any copyright issue. I can't help myself. Their family members had believed, at least, so this is Mary's family members, they had believed that the boy was put up for adoption through a Catholic organization shortly after his birth, and he was born on January 13th, 1953, and this was when his mother was 21 years old. A family member of Mary spoke with the media and suggested that Abel put her son up for adoption, which was something that she had done previously with a daughter she gave birth to in 1950. I think partly because, you know, her having kids outside of wedlock was a huge, huge, you do not do that. Mm-mm. No, no, no. And that, you know, overall her family, believes that she did not have anything to do with her son's death. Mary later on went to marry her manager at the movie theater where she worked, and his name is Joseph Plunkett. And together they had four children. And she died in, I believe it was 1991. She died in the 90s. And that was due to lung cancer from asbestos exposure. And Joseph's father, Gus Zarelli, worked in construction. He was married for 55 years with four children and nine grandchildren. So, you know, this was, you know, not something super, I mean, it was not something that was talked about in either family, or at least not in the Zarelli family, maybe in the Abel family, the Plunkett family, it maybe was. Gus and his family were heavily criticized and attacked on multiple fronts by social media with baseless claims that, you know, they, I think essentially people are like, oh, you're responsible for Joseph's death and this and that, although it's very possible that he didn't even know that Joseph existed. I feel like that's very possible in this situation, since no one in the Zarelli family even knew that they were related to the boy in the box, and his family was entirely blindsided about their relationship and their, like, familial ties to him. And nobody knew the extent of the relationship between him and Mary and any of that. So either he didn't tell him because he probably just didn't want to, but also it's possible that, you know, he didn't know. And there was one point where an Ohio woman came forward and claimed to be his mother and that she bought Joseph from his parents in 1954. So would not have worked since he was, I mean, maybe if, it depends on when she would have given him up for adoption, I guess, if she did it right away or didn't. But that she bought this boy and kept him in the basement of her home, which, I mean, how do you, what? You bought a boy from somebody, which, I mean, that's just weird in the first place. But then to just keep them in the basement because you don't want your parents to know that you have this boy is so weird. So that's what this woman is claiming, and that she killed him in a fit of rage, but nothing in that story could be corroborated at all. And it just sounds fake to me, honestly. But police did use genealogical DNA to identify Joseph and reconstructed a family tree, kind of working backwards in a way. And once they were able to figure out who his, like, parents were, they were able to get a birth certificate. So they found him through his mother's DNA first, and they were able to actually confirm his age, that he was 4 years old and he had just turned four, like a month before he was found murdered. And they also then learned who his biological father was and had a name for him. And they do have suspicion as to who is responsible for his death, but they have stated that it would be irresponsible to release the information or to give out the names of his biological parents because of their surviving relatives. So, I mean, we all know what happened as far as, like, he was alive and then he was no longer alive, and that's, you know, a problem. But hopefully we will have more information soon and this can actually, like, come to a close, which is so exciting, because when I first heard about this case, I honestly was like, they're never gonna find who it is, they're never gonna know. And I mean, this was like six years ago when I was in college finishing up my senior year, like, watching this video from BuzzFeed Unsolved, I think is where, yeah, it was BuzzFeed Unsolved, and I was like, interesting. Tell me more. And this leads us to the Delphi murders, which we also did an update episode on for episode 29, so those two are closely together. It is also one that I found, I can't remember if I found this one through BuzzFeed Unsolved or if I first heard it through, probably, And That's Why We Drink. I love that podcast, by the way, if anyone's looking for another fun one to listen to outside of all of the ones that we have, like, promoted on our network and stuff. That's a They're a great one. So, things in the Delphi murder case. It's getting real spicy. This is a spicy case. And as we all know, if you're not well-versed in this, Google it, watch something about it. We don't have anything on it just because our story for it was an update versus like actually going through the story. So I believe this one is also called the Snapchat murders. I'm pretty sure, I'm not 100% sure. But as we know, Richard Allen has been accused of the murders of Abby Williams and Libby German near the Manan High Bridge in Delphi, Indiana, in February of 2017. And as of right now, his murder trial is currently scheduled to begin on May 13th of this year. And as of 5 days ago, so this is April 11th, it was brought forward that he has been making some incriminating statements to both inmates and guards with his prison sentencing and, you know, being in prison until his trials. And his team, so Allen's attorney, has been saying that he's been making these statements in a state of psychosis. And in this, he has reportedly made a phone call to his wife in which he admitted over, you know, the police recorded phone that he killed the girls. And he has also had reports of confessions to guards and other inmates at the facility of the same thing. And as of right now, his attorneys are trying to say that it's the result of psychological and mental coercion and that it's illegally directed against Allen and that him making these statements is involuntary. Who's to say at this point? His team has also claimed that he has been on suicide watch during a majority of his stay and that he was being treated worse than the most heinous convicted offenders at the prison that he is staying at, which is the Westville Correction Facility, if I did not state that earlier. And a judge did rule on his treatment and stated that he was actually being treated better than most of the inmates. So I am going to say that it is possible he is being treated inhumanely, but even that inhumane treatment is still better than what most people are getting. So that is something that could be happening. I don't know. I'm not there. I can't tell you the truth. I don't know. I will say that it was reported that he wasn't doing anything strange, like he's been known to eat paper until he like had this confession with his wife. So he had this confession and now he's acting like erratically and weirdly, which is kind of a red flag in a way to, you know, have these confessions and then be like, oh, well, like, now I'm going to act like I'm being crazy because the whole I'm going to use insanity defense on my side when that's kind of not how that works because it's at the time the crime was committed, not how you were acting now. So there's that. And I will say it's definitely best to probably question the validity of some of these statements he's making. Also because there's so many times where people say in prison, especially like, you know, if they're trying to like seem tougher to other inmates, they'll like either add on to what they've done or they'll make these like false claims, which it happens a lot with like serial killers when like there's a serial killer going around they will be like, oh, like I did X amount of, like I killed X amount of people. And it's like, maybe they didn't actually kill that many, or maybe they did and we haven't found the rest of the victims. But more than likely, they inflate the numbers, or, you know, say that they did stuff that they didn't because they either want to seem tougher or they want the recognition for whatever reason. So he has been telling other inmates that he molested Abby and Libby before he shot them in the back, which is not supported by any of their autopsies for them being sexually assaulted or being shot. They were, I think it was, they were killed by blunt force trauma, or I think it was either that or they were stabbed. I, as you can see, there are so many cases and stuff that I look into that I don't always remember all of those little details for every single case. But either way, things are not lining up, and that we know. And I will say that if it would be great if there was some sort of like truth to this, because he has also added like, oh, like I've molested these girls and these other ones, that like if there was actual truth to any of that, that any previous victims would then come forward. But I also feel like it's not necessarily true, and that he's trying to kind of come across as like being mentally unstable and being mentally insane, which, I mean, I feel like you could definitely get that way from prison and in prison. But I definitely think he, if he committed these crimes, that he knew what he was doing at that time. And that's my personal opinion. And then as of Monday, so yesterday, April 15th, there was a file to suppress a recorded interrogation from the police. And his attorneys are stating that the reason they want this taken off the record was that his civil rights were violated and that he was never read his Miranda rights before he was questioned. But I am going to say I definitely adhere to like this crime junkie rule that like just get a lawyer. If there's any question, get a lawyer. Don't talk to anyone. There's nothing wrong with protecting yourself, especially if like you are innocent. I feel like that happens where, you know, you're like, oh, well, like I'm innocent, so nothing's going to happen. I was like, well, you don't know that. So just get a lawyer. Or if you're under 18, get a parent and then get a lawyer. Do not talk to them, even if you didn't do anything wrong. It's, well, and it's also because it's such a high stress situation that, you know, you can get tripped. If you're like me, you can get tripped up over things and it's scary and your heart is racing and you're panicking. So do yourself a favor and just get the lawyer. And he's also hoping to get two other interviews stricken from the record as evidence because he feels that he was lied to by police. And when this like first interrogation happened, it was when he was first arrested days before his arrest was actually announced. And it's mostly over what did or didn't happen in the interview that should have. And at the time, Alan and his wife drove to Delphi to Indiana State Police at their office post in Lafayette on October 26, 2022. And this was to pick up a vehicle of theirs that had been seized by the state and by the state police 13 days earlier. And when they went to get it, they separated him and his wife and they questioned him. So I'm assuming the police had a warrant for his vehicle, and that's why they had it in the first place. But I also feel like if the police have your vehicle and they have a warrant for your vehicle, you should be expecting that they want to talk to you. I mean, that's, I feel like that is like the logical thing to come to at this point in time. But I can see that if, you know, you're thinking you are innocent and that nothing's going to happen, like, why would they want to talk to you? Because you didn't do anything wrong, right? So I can see both sides of it. But basically, they're saying that they didn't inform him that, like, you know, the whole, like, you have a right to return an attorney, anything you can say or and will be held against you under a court of law, that you can leave at any time if you want to, like, because you're not actually under arrest, that you can leave. They can't force you to stay there. And they are also saying that they didn't tell him that he was being recorded. And I kind of have a problem with this one because Indiana, like Colorado where I live, is a one-party consent state for recording, which people get into like a lot of the ethics as to whether or not that should happen. But it is assumed that when you're in a public space or in state sanctioned areas or county, town, any of that, so like a police station, a fire station, a hospital, that, you know, you are being recorded on like their own security system, like CCTV type footage. And because it is one party consent, they don't have to tell you you're being recorded because they consented to it. So there's that. But I also feel like you should just kind of assume that like that's happening at a police station, you know, because it's the police station. They should have surveillance and all of that. Like, of course you're being recorded. That is also my opinion, though. But part of the issue that they are having, his lawyers, is that they believe that part of the interview never existed and that they didn't turn on everything at the beginning of when like they should have recorded. So not getting them going through like his Miranda rights or anything like that. And that it was either taken out like later on or they didn't turn the camera on until after that. And I think the thing that is kind of tripping me up a little bit is that the attorney is stating that it's unusual police activity that they interrogated him for 2 hours and didn't allow him to leave, which if they did actually read him his Miranda rights, then he would have known that he could leave if he really wanted to. But also, I know plenty of stories where they've interviewed someone for like up to like 15 hours or like something super long before anything happened. So I feel like in comparison, 2 hours doesn't feel like anything. But I mean, I also personally never want to be questioned by police because it would scare me and it would be stressful and I would hate it. So I also understand that 2 hours probably felt like a very long time. So, I mean, I also don't know if there's any other unusual activity that in the articles that I read was like omitted. So it's very possible that there are other things that the lawyers are seeing and they're like, this kind of doesn't add up right. You're being real shady and weird, but, you know, news media doesn't want to tell you that. So it's, you know, his lawyers are doing their job at the end of the day. They're doing their job. They're trying to make sure that their client, who they believe is innocent, is, you know, getting a fair trial and all of that, or, you know, someone who is presumed innocent until proven guilty without a shadow of the doubt. So with these recordings, if they are stricken from the record, which they're asking that the jurors are not allowed to see or hear them, that it would remove evidence of him denying his involvement and the officer questioning him, getting pretty peeved with him at the time. And it would also get rid of evidence of Allen stating that there was no way around from his gun would be found at the murder scene, which, I mean, if a gun was never used, I would question as to whether or not rounds would have been found in the first place. So it's just interesting to see what stuff is kind of coming up with this and what's going to happen. I personally am very much looking forward to when they have the case. And I mean, I'm hoping that I'll be able to like live stream it or something from the courthouse, which I don't know if they'll allow that or not. It just depends. It depends on the state, depends on whether or not they have media bans and stuff like that. But either way, it's definitely compelling and it's going to be interesting to see what evidence is presented and all of that. So I am just looking forward to it and excited. That is all of the updates that I have for everyone. So if you like this and you want to see what other updates we're going to have, check out our Patreon. I'm going to be doing this on there as like a regular thing. Our lowest tier is like $5 a month. So it's going to be available starting at the lowest tier. And then I believe our highest tier will just get these episodes a few days earlier. So if, you know, you can't wait and you have to have it before everyone else, that is the tier for you. And other than that, you know, look out for our next episode next week and us kind of getting back into the swing of things after our crazy break of stuff. Follow us on all of the socials. So Instagram, we're at Peculiar Pairings Pod. Same for X. I think I'm probably going to be trying to post some stuff on YouTube shortly, so keep an eye out on that. Let's see. Patreon. I think that's about all we have as socials. You can email us at peculiarpairingspod@gmail.com. You can send us story ideas, stuff like that on there. And other than that, we will see you next time. And, you know, next time Matt will be with me. So, you know, you won't have me trying to tell you all my bad jokes and all of that. So hopefully you guys enjoyed today's episode and we will see you next week. Bye.